welcome to the For the Reef podcast. My name is Mitch Stender, fisheries biologist and founder of For the Reef Apparel, with co-host Ian Bell, LFS owner and first responder. We're going to get that right one of these times. The timing.
You just got to laugh.
Our goal is to bring our fish nerd conversations from the fish room floor to your living room while bridging the gap between the hobbyist and coral reef conservation. So today, Ian and I are pretty excited. We're going to talk about ick in particular and quarantine in a general sense and all those fun things.
Yeah. Fish disease is something that bothers all of us, and it's gotten even trickier here in Canada since the Minister of Health took all our meds away. So for the average hobbyist, that makes things a lot more challenging. You either have to bring something in from the US or you have to find alternative methods. In a fish store on its own, because you have high turnover of livestock all the time, it's a constant battle. So there's things that we employ to try and manage that and stay ahead of it. But Mitch is going to talk about, I guess, sort of what sets it off. I mean, let's say it's already on your fish, but what triggers that fish to be more susceptible? What makes it, you know, less likely to be able to fight it off?
Right. Yeah, like one of the biggest things that kind of tipped me onto this, you know, diving a little deeper into understanding ick, understanding quarantine, understanding fish health on a deeper level, is through, I guess initially, just by understanding more about stress and hormones. I spent some time doing research on that kind of thing. So
I think we should touch on real quick what your background is, Mitch. Why are you the qualified guy to talk about this topic, more so than myself, for example? I know you did go to the number two school there in this topic. So give everybody a little bit of your educational background and what you do for a living.
The education, blah, 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 that stuff's like, oh yeah, Ian loves that. But you know, the education and stuff like that is whatever. I think that anybody who's passionate about this kind of stuff, takes the time and dives into it, can talk about it. And there's examples of it all over. You know, most of the best hobbyists are guys who, you know, they're car mechanics and fish hobbyists on the side. And then they talk about something that they're really passionate about and they can dive really deep. So I don't think my education has anything to do with why I'm qualified to talk on this. During my master's, I did my master's thesis was on the interaction between hormones in Chinook salmon.
Sure. But to be fair to you, your background does sort of lend itself a little bit more to understanding the biology of what's going on than maybe the average Joe might.
Right. I have my master's, and technically it's in environmental science, but my master's thesis was in fish biology and endocrinology and the interactions between hormones and behaviors and how you can understand those interactions to optimize growth. We can kind of save that. I think that's a fun to talk about. We can always, you know, dive into what that research was about. I think that, you know, aquaculture and understanding, you know, what makes fish healthy, what makes fish eat and grow and all those types of things. That's all stuff that I kind of covered during my, you know, graduate work. So we can definitely talk about that some other time. It's going to be a good long podcast and to go into all that, but yeah, basically I did my master's in fish biology and specialized in stress and how stress affects fish. So
I definitely know that this is one of the bigger topics that I get asked about in the store all the time, even more so now that the meds are gone. And Pat from Reef Wholesale and I talk about this topic for hours on end because he deals with an even higher volume of fish than I do. And it's a constant struggle trying to stay ahead of things.
Yeah, the first thing that really got me interested in this was thinking about, well, shit, we are living in Canada and we can't get a lot of these medications anymore. So that is a struggle in its own, because just to stay on topic, we have you know, we're talking about ick. So ick being a parasite, right? You have all these different things that can be considered, things that can make your fish sick, whether it be pests like ick, it can be parasites like ick, it can be bacterias, it can be fungus, it can be viruses. We all know about one specific virus that is going around our planet right now. So these are all stressors that happen in our aquariums, and we have certain tools in our toolbox to fight against them. So right now, I mean, with ick, the standard, the gold standard, I guess, in ick eradication. So to give everyone an idea of what I'm talking about here, so we have ick eradication, which means, you know, as the guys at BRS call it sometimes, scorching the earth, meaning you kill all the ick. There's no ick in your tank. Ick has to get into your tank. There has to be a source for ick to get into your tank. The parasite doesn't just fall out of thin air. It has to come from somewhere. It's just really, really difficult to keep it out if you're not quarantining your fish. If you're
born and your corals and your inverts.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
I was listening to a podcast with Humblefish just the other day, and he was saying, you know, if you're not quarantining your corals and things like that for 72 days, you're not talking eradication anymore. You're talking management.
Right. And that's something too. Like I read a paper about that too. And basically if there's no fish in the tank, these ick won't live on invertebrates or corals or things like that. They're not going to live on those for very long. As hardy as ick is, its life cycle is so short that the degradation time of the populations in the tank tend to die off. So what I'm getting at here is if you are taking corals and rocks and fish from other tanks that have fish in them, you're very well introducing ick into your tank. The nice thing is that if the ick is on those things, it's likely that you can get them off, you know, through some quick quarantining. Even just doing quick freshwater dips is really effective in actually allowing adult icks to fall off. So, I mean, the whole quarantine thing, we can get into that, and I guess we're jumping into it. But if you're taking, say, rock, or you're taking someone else's equipment, the greatest thing you can do is let it dry out. So you take equipment from somebody else's tank, let it dry out before you put it in your tank. Then you're pretty sure that whatever was on it is gone, with some ones that could get by, but drying it out is pretty good at getting rid of everything. Another one is freshwater dips. Ick, when they're in it, works vice versa. So there's two different types of ick that we commonly deal with in our hobby. There's the freshwater one and the saltwater one. The saltwater one, when you dip it in freshwater, it tends to dislodge. So in all the studies that I was reading, the way that they would count the number of ick parasites that were on a fish is by dipping it in fresh water and then counting them. So
I do that at the store, and you can't actually see them pop right off. And then you look in the bottom, you see them all floating around in there.
Yeah. So it's like, it's definitely something you can do. But I mean, to get back to the whole ick eradication thing is, unless you're doing all this stuff, the chances of you actually keeping ick out of your tank is really small. And I know from my own experience, you know, I've been in the hobby for a long time now, and I know, like, I just assume ick's in all my tanks because it's just really difficult to keep it out. I do quarantine, I do all that stuff, but I didn't when I first started my tank. I've, you know, there's always instances where you can just let them in. If you don't and you go this ick eradication route, then you can treat with copper. That's the gold standard. Put your fish in quarantine them in copper, leave them in there for about 3 weeks in a quarantine tank, monitor their behavior, and they should be clear of any parasites.
Since we're touching on the copper thing, you can't just throw some copper in there and cross your fingers. It has to be a very specific range depending on which kind of copper you're using, and you have to maintain that range, and if you don't, you might as well start over. Mm-hmm. It takes time, and it takes care to do this. And it is actually interesting to me. And I kind of wonder what's going to happen after COVID, because if anybody should understand quarantine and what's going on in the world, it should be reef keepers. Yet the small number of people I see that actually quarantine their fish is surprising. And I wonder if sort of what's going on in the world now will change people's minds or go, you know, maybe I should put a little more effort into this and protect my pet.
Yeah, probably not. No, who knows?
It's a philosophical conversation, right? Like, would you do it for your dog? You probably would. So what's the difference around your pet fish, which probably, if you take care of it right, could live longer.
Yeah, and unfortunately, like, even for me, you know, I've read a lot into this stuff, and even for me, it took I had marine velvet get into one of my tanks, wiped out a few fish that I've had for a really long time. I had a yellow tang that was probably 8 or 10 years old, got wiped out in a day from marine velvet. And unfortunately, that's how most people end up getting into quarantine, and how most people end up changing
their perception.
Yeah, I guess
their
rhythms,
whether they're going to do it or not.
Yeah, exactly.
There are people far more in tune with quarantine and how to treat fish than I am. Humble Fish would be one. Go on his blog. He's done a lot of looking into this. There's great information in there, but you gotta look, or you're going to have to do the next step, which is management.
Right. Yeah. And back to Humble Fish, he's the one who first coined these ideas of ick eradication and ick management. So ick eradication makes sense. Wipe them out. Ick management is the other one. And I think that ick management is one where I want to dive deeper in. And that's why I, you know, came up with this idea of ick tipping points, because it helped me understand how ick is a living thing in your tank and you're managing the ecosystem, right? Whenever we think about our tanks as an ecosystem and not like a machine, you know, we don't just, okay, we've got this problem, just plug in a bunch of alkalinity. Oh, we've got this problem, just throw in a bunch of a certain fish and it'll get rid of it. Like, it's better to think of your tank as what's the entire ecology of your tank and how is that ecosystem going to be in flux, right? It's always this constant battle in your tank. So your tank's always this battleground. I always like to think of it that way. So ick management is under that premise that there's ick in your tank, and that's okay. There's parasites in the wild, and that's okay. It's only when those parasites get the upper hand and start winning that battle. So the idea of an ick tipping point is kind of, I've thought of it from climate change. You know, you hear about climate change tipping points. They're points of kind of no return. So like with ick, one way to think about it, so the example here is, so you have an ick population that's in your tank. Let's just say it's in the thousands of individuals that are inside your 50-gallon tank. So let's put everything in examples. So you want to manage that population so that it doesn't show up on your fish. It usually takes, there was a paper that I was reading, usually takes the population, like, so the number of individuals in the tank needs to get up near 1,000 or more before they start to attach to the fish. So if you think of your fish as having the ability to fight off parasites, and it can fight off a few, no big deal. You know, the parasites, the ick parasite goes for the eyes and the gills and it eats on that tissue. And the fish can easily defend those parasites as long as they're in reasonable numbers. The exact same as, you know, put Ian in a room with a wasp, and he'll probably be okay. Put him in a room with
maybe,
exactly. Put him in a room with 10 wasps. He's probably still going to make it, right? He might have a little bit of damage, but he'll be all right. Put him in a room with 10,000 wasps and Ian could die. Yeah. we don't want Ian to die.
Yeah. To take that analogy one step further, if you're allergic or more prone or have a weaker immune system as a person or as a fish.
Yeah.
Exponentially changes the effect on your
exactly
ability to fight that off.
Yep. and take somebody who's sick and put them in that same room with 10 wasps, and it might be a different situation. So that's the whole idea. And there's these different tiers of how a fish can respond to ick. So I posted a YouTube video about this. I don't post a lot of YouTube videos, but I had one where I put some work into it on this topic.
Mitch was all lined up to be one of our speakers at the Niagara Coral Show last year. So he put a lot of work into this talk, and then everything kind of hit the fan and didn't want to let his speech to go to waste. So we'll take that YouTube talk and we'll post it in the notes.
Yeah. Like it's condensed. It's just a 12-minute thing. And silver lining is the talks evolved, you know, like it started off just, I wanted to talk about the effects of cortisol, AKA the stress hormone, on fish and in quarantine. And then it evolved into, well, let's go to a level that people actually, you know, want to hear about first. So then it was about ick. And then we just kept kind of, and then I just kept diving into ick. But then, you know, this presentation is going to get better and better. And it was a good way to kind of put all this research into a condensed version that even I can go back and remember. So yeah, that's a good video to go and check out. But to kind of give the gist of what's in there is, so the example that I give in that video is, let's just take a tank, right? Here's your normal beginner's aquarium, 30 gallon tank, 50 gallon tank, you know, whatever, 50 gallon tank. You put two clownfish and a leopard wrasse into that tank, right? So, and I'm just going to throw out ballpark numbers because I don't have any visuals because it's a podcast, but I'll just throw out some ballpark numbers. Let's just say on a tank with two clownfish and leopard wrasse, assuming all things that those fish are healthy and happy, low stress, those fish, the ick tipping point on those fish is, let's just say, when the number of ick individuals gets to, say, 2,000, then all of a sudden you might have a problem, right? Because then one fish might succumb to the ick, and the ick parasites will then grow because they'll have a source of food and grow in population. If they don't, the number of individuals in the tank will probably stay below that tipping point, and you won't actually see any mortalities in your tank. So the ick is in your tank. Occasionally, it's probably bothering the fish, but you're never getting to a point where it's like causing wounds that could kill the fish. So the reason why I gave the example of two clownfish and a leopard wrasse is because those fish typically have a strong immune system to ick. They're generally hardy fish. They do well in captivity. So their stress is low, their immune system's up, and they have a number of things that help them keep ick off their bodies. So in that tank, your ick tipping point is going to be pretty high. Staying on this idea of fish communities, say we take a powder blue tang and put that tang into that tank, right? Say your ick tipping point was like 2,000. Now all of a sudden, maybe your ick tipping point's only 500 individuals. And what I'm saying, and don't get caught up in the numbers, but all I'm saying is, like, a powder blue tang is a fish that's really susceptible to ick, and has its slime coat isn't very good. It doesn't have much behavioral traits to keep it off. And what's likely is it doesn't see that parasite very often in the wild. So it hasn't built up an immune system to deal with them in high numbers. So you take this powder blue tang and you stick it into the tank. So what could happen is, if ick pair populations are getting high in your tank, you know, and they're getting up into that range where they're starting to overwhelm the powder blue tang, and now they're feeding on that powder blue tang and they're increasing in numbers, and now they're starting to increase to a point where they could start infecting your other fish. So as these numbers climb, you're putting more and more fish at risk until you hit a point where the population of ick parasites is just getting out of control. They're feeding on all the fish that are sickly and hurting because they're being eaten by parasites. And what can happen is it wipes out your entire tank. With parasites like ick, that can take some time. With other things like marine velvet, as we all know, it can happen in a day or two. And marine velvet's kind of a separate thing, beast. So just for today, we'll just stick to ick. But that's the way, you know, as far as fish communities go, is a good way to think about it. So when, just to like, because if I don't cut myself off right now, the other things I wanted to talk about was, how can you lower or make higher the tipping point? So how can you make your tank, AKA, more resilient to ick? But before I get there, let's talk about how this even applies to you in the fish stores, and like, what, you know, what do you find? Do you see a lot of ick? Do you see a lot of marine velvet? What type of things do you deal with in the
ick's pretty common. Mm-hmm. Depending where you get your fish from, but also the stresses that they've been under, how long the travel is. With some care, you can deal with it. Velvet, if you're going to see velvet, it's probably too late. If you're seeing it to that degree, you can make your last ditch efforts. But my experience is you've lost that fish.
Yep.
So now it's trying to care for the rest of them. Uranema is a common one that we're seeing in a little bit more lately. There's arguments that it's due to climate change or warming or different things like that, but you're seeing it a lot in green chromis, for example, and certain anthea. Mm-hmm. So those are stuff that, you know, you're not your average aquarist, right? Because at home, you're bringing in a couple fish, you take care, you put them in your tank, and that's it. In a store, you've got fish coming and going every week. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to try and do what you can to manage that. You know, the gold standard would be, sure, we can take every fish, quarantine it, and medicate it or whatever is necessary for 30, 40 days, and then release into the public. I mean, I'm sure everybody would like that. The problem is that not everybody's going to like the cost associated with that. There's a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of man hours that goes into that. There's only one guy that I know of in Ontario that will do that for you, and you're going to pay 2.5 times the fish for it, because it's time. It's no different than paying a contractor, right? He's got to put the time into that. There are people out there that say they do things. What do they do? Do they watch the fish for a couple of days and then say, yeah, they're good to go? There's varying levels. Like, what does quarantine mean to that individual? So you have to check, right? And I would hope that any of us that own stores, we do the best that we can for these fish, but I think it comes down to the individual too, has to take on some of that. You're taking care and ownership of this fish and its livelihood. You should do the best that you can for it.
Yep. And you know, that's funny that you say that. Like, with quarantine, it's a saying that I really like. It's excuse my language here. It's either a hell yes or a fuck no. And so that's a great way to think about quarantine. You know, it's either hell yes, let's do quarantine, or F no, I'm not going to do it. And that's because if you don't do it full on, like if you're really trying for ick eradication, you've got to try to, you have to do it right. You have to do everything right. You have to make sure you know, there's a lot of steps to quarantining fish properly. Yeah. So yeah,
a 5-minute talk in the fish store isn't going to do it. You need to have done some research into this, like everything else beforehand, before you launch into that.
Yeah.
Make sure that you're prepared. You're not reacting, you're proactive.
Yes. And there is still really, really valid reasons to quarantine fish. Even if you're assuming that you're not going to totally deal with ick at the source, you're not, you know, getting rid of ick, or, you know, you're not doing perfect quarantine. There are still reasons to do quarantine, and I can, you know, I do quarantine because it helps with the ick, with, you know, things like ick populations and everything else. It also just gives your fish a lot of time to recover, and I can talk about cortisol and stress and things like that and why that matters. But it's also, I find the biggest value is it just allows you to sit there, see that fish, give him the whole tank to himself, and just be able to feed it without competition, and let that fish have a fighting chance when it gets thrown into, you know, the reef tank. It gives them a chance to kind of settle in and get prepared for the battle that they're about to go in when they get thrown into a new tank. So yeah, like on a store level, it's when you're buying fish, I guess I think if you're going to pay for a quarantined fish, you better check into how that fish was quarantined. If you're paying extra, I would double check to see how that fish was actually quarantined. Try to get the details. If they don't want to give you the details, then chances are that fish probably wasn't quarantined properly. Yeah. And you're taking proper a chance.
Quarantine is he's isolated that fish. He's medicated that fish. He's watched it. He's probably done tank transfers, blah, 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 blah. There's a lot of time that goes into that. The average store owner just doesn't have the manpower or facilities space to even do that. It's not that we wouldn't like to, it's just logistically tricky. Yeah. So most of the better stores will at least have medicated their tank, be running copper and stuff to do the best that we can, water changes, trying to do decent feeding. That's probably fairly normal to expect. Yeah. I know for sure that there are some fish stores out there that I've seen around the continent that their tanks are packed with fish. They just came in. Oh yeah, we quarantine. Well, what does that mean? You watched them for a couple of days and now it's the weekend, so let's kick them out the door. Like,
yeah.
There's all different levels, right? So you should ask a few questions.
Yeah.
What does quarantine mean to that individual?
For sure.
Because it's a very broad term otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, like a good rule of thumb is if you're not paying triple for a quarantined fish, then it probably wasn't quarantined. Because there's no reason why I think a fish store owner would put in all of that work, you know, all that extra time, all that extra, you know, cost and not market it because it's worth something.
You would have to. It legit, you literally couldn't do it unless you charged more for it because you're going to have to have more manpower to do it. There's no way you could do what's required to quarantine all those fish 100% and keep up with everything you're going to do. And that costs. And to expect that it doesn't isn't reasonable.
Yeah.
I think you're going to see more people offer that service. It's definitely something that I'm considering in the future when I have more time and manpower to do it. Mm-hmm. I think it will be the future, but there definitely will be a cost associated with it. And then it comes down to the individual. Do you see that as, I'm willing to pay for a quarantine fish and medicated and treated. And even then there's no guarantee. Mm-hmm. You can't ask the fish if everything's great, like you're doing the best you can, but with a reasonable expectation that you've probably got it, or are you the kind of aquarist who just sees it as a commodity? Like fish is a fish. I'm not willing to pay for that. Maybe it's going to come down to where you'll see two sets of tanks in the store. Mm-hmm. These are quarantined. They cost this. These were just brought in. We're doing their best with them, but they're not strictly quarantined. And that's that.
Yep.
I don't have the answers to that. It comes down to each individual's sort of take on it, but to expect that you're going to walk into the average fish store and say, I want to quarantine fish and it's going to cost you $50. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, no.
It just logistically cannot happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even like with COVID going on and prices of fish having to go up because of everything that's going on, you know, it makes you even think too, like maybe that, you know, we were talking about how people could have changed their behaviors from COVID. Maybe because of COVID, the cost of fish is up right now. And, you know, there's even more incentive that if you're going to pay that much money for a fish, that you're going to quarantine it properly. I mean, I can understand sometimes.
Shipping has done a number on the pricing for sure.
Yes. Yeah.
The getting airspace is first of all the problem. And then what they're charging for that airspace is different.
Yeah.
And you look around and you see all different kinds of pricing for fish. And you see guys blowing out fish really, really cheap. Is that because they're just trying to clear them or have they brought them in a less than great way? Mm-hmm. Whether that be legal or not, we're not, that's a whole nother topic. And along with that, sometimes it's pricing, but if you're expecting that fish that's less than everybody else has been quarantined properly,
kicked
out the door for less than every other fish store around, I smell snake oil.
Yep. Oh, for sure. And so that was made me think too about the stress. So stress is an interesting thing in how it works in the body and how we respond to stress and how, you know, the way fish deal with stress and the hormones that are created, they work through the same basic axis as it works in our bodies. So the main one is cortisol, which most people have heard of cortisol. Cortisol is known as the stress hormone. It's the fight or flight hormone. Basically what cortisol does is it mobilizes sugars in your body, which gives you which makes energy available to you. So whether that be in the absence of food, or whether that be in a time when you have something's going on where you have to respond. So let's say the fight situation. So cortisol happens throughout the day. Your body creates cortisol. Fish create cortisol throughout the day, just regularly. You know, for example, early in the morning, cortisol spikes in humans. It spikes in fish too, in most fish, depending on what their feeding behaviors are. But it spikes in the morning because it's like, oh, okay, you're awake. You've digested your food over the night. Let's mobilize some sugars here so we can get up and go find some food. So you'll find that regularly. So cortisol, you know, especially in our day and age, we hear a lot about the stress hormone and we're told it's all bad. But really, cortisol is incredibly important, just like all steroid hormones. They're just something that needs to be, you know, managed. It's that you can't have too much. Too much is a bad thing. Too little is a bad thing. You kind of want things to swing around and need it. You want it when you need it, and you don't want it when you don't need it. If that makes any sense. So basically, to give the short here is like, you want cortisol to be available in the fish. If you're putting food into the tank, if the fish needs to defend itself, if the fish is exposed to a parasite, for example, all of those things are needing to trigger a response. So what cortisol will do is it'll spike up, and that'll cause an immune response, a behavioral response. It gets you some energy, gets you out there fighting that thing off. And then what you want is it to come right back down, and you want that cortisol to get used up and then go away. It's like a little shot. You want that. Problem is when it's prolonged, it starts to degrade proteins, and then it creates problems. So if cortisol spikes up, so let's just think of it in practical sense. You know, you're a diver, you go out and you take a fish from the reef in Australia, right? Then goes to a boat. So now there's this spike in hormone initially as the fish tries to get away from the diver. It's caught by the diver. It's put into a tank. Now it's in this environment. It doesn't know what's going on. So the cortisol is staying high, and it's starting to cause negative effects. Like, it suppresses your appetite. It starts to lower your immune system. It starts to burn energy that you don't want to be burned. It starts to break down muscle. So all these things are bad things. And now this fish is going to be going through that stress for a long time, until the time where it finally hits the wholesaler. Now it's stressed out, might have a little bit of a break. And then it gets stressed out again when it gets shipped out to the retailer. It's sitting with the retailer for a while. And then it finally gets to the home aquarium, where hopefully it lives its life for a while, or forever. And that's finally where this stress is starting to go down. So when you think of it in those terms, you really want to try your best to make low stress environments for the fish as it's going through different processes. So you can do types of things like, you know, darkening the tanks, putting in structure and hiding places, all of those common sense things that you know will help fish, good foods, things like that. Not putting it in tanks where it's going to be attacked by other fish. Doing things like, as a person who's buying the fish, going to the retailer when they're getting the fish in from the wholesaler, taking that bag straight from them if they'll allow you to do it, saves an entire journey.
Yeah, we do that quite often. If I know someone's specifically looking for a fish, I'll tell them the day that it's coming, and they'll come and take it right out of the bag, because I try as best I can to not leave. Sometimes you have to ship fish overnight to where your location is. That's a thing. But if I, as much as possible, we try and have the fish packed, go pick them up and bring them directly back to the store. So they're in the bag as minimum of time as possible. The water's as good as it possibly can be. And if you can come take your fish and take it home directly from there, it's one step of that whole process, like you said, that you've eliminated.
Because you want them to lower that cortisol as fast as possible, because it might have been causing negative effects for a while now. So one more good reason to quarantine, right? Because if you have a stressed fish that's gone through this traveling process, you bring it home to your tank and you throw it into, you know, your busy established tank that has a whole bunch of fish in it. Now it's competing for food, it's stressed out, it might be getting bullied. All of those things could be contributing to prolonging that that stress. So getting it in quarantine allows that stress hormone to come down. So we all know those things, you know, we all know like that's what quarantine does and blah, blah, blah. But I think sometimes it helps when you are able to actually, when you're able to actually see the or hear on a biological level, how it's being affected by. You still there?
Yep.
Okay. Sorry. It just, blurred out there for a second. But I think it just helps understand why quarantine and stuff like that matters when you understand what's actually going on with the hormones.
Sure. And if you think about even your ourselves, take something as simple as a vacation. You've gone away on holidays, you've been running around, you've been having a good time. Now you got to get to the airport, you got to get through customs, you got to get back on the plane. You're sitting on the plane, you don't like the guy sitting next to you, he smells funny. And then you're like stressed out the whole way because he's ignorant. You're getting off the plane. Now you got to find your luggage. All your luggage is missing. You had to go to this. You get out of the airport. You got home. You got on the bus. There's a traffic jam. You got all the way home.
Yeah.
Now I feel better, right?
Yeah.
Same kind of situation.
Yeah. And everybody wonders why you get sick after vacation.
Yeah.
You know, it's because you're stressed out. And it's the same reason why, you know, our daily lives of people, you know, maybe you go to work every day and you hate your job. So you're spending most of the day being stressed out. So in theory, your cortisol levels are high and they're starting to, instead of doing a good thing, they're doing bad things. Same thing's happening with our fish. So all the more reason too, during COVID, you know, and we'll get into the deep debate on whether, you know, gyms should be closed or anything like that, but it's just, it's really too bad that everything is about shutting things down and that's the way things have to be, when I think it would be really, really helpful to talk about nutrition, talk about exercise, talk about well-being and happiness and all of those things that contribute to your immune system and your actual ability to fight this virus off. It's just not something that's getting talked about. And I understand why we stick to keep people apart, because it's the easiest way to implement something that's going to work. But I just think, you know, it would be good to discuss nutrition and stress and all those things that keep you healthy, on a deeper level than just saying, you know, cover your mouth when you're coughing. But it's like, again, that's like, that's a whole nother thing.
That'd be hard to do on a national level too. Yeah. Right? It's hard to pull that off.
Exactly. I mean, at the same time though, we're digging here, but let's just, at the same time, you know, if we can tell people to wash their hands, we can tell people to exercise in these pamphlets, you know.
Well, to be fair, they've probably been telling us that since we were in kindergarten, yet we still all go to McDonald's and do whatever, right?
That's
so
fair.
It's an uphill battle.
It's
anyways,
true. It's,
we digress.
yeah, that's a big topic. But anyway, back to the fish here. That's kind of the idea with stress. So I kind of covered it here on what could be going on with ick tipping points in your tank, right? So one of the examples that I gave in the video is, you know, let's just say you have a tank. It's got those same clownfish and the leopard grass, but you have a faulty power head in the tank that's leaking electricity into your tank, and it's just kind of slowly bugging your fish. And it goes on for a couple months, just kind of zapping your fish here and there. So their cortisol levels are steadily going up until a point where their immune system starts to go down. So their immune system starts to go down, and what goes with it is that ick tipping point. So now all of a sudden, the ick populations, instead of having to get to, say, 2,000, now they only have to get up to like 1,000 before they start visibly showing on the fish. And, you know, start to multiply at a rate that the fish can't defend. So that's the idea with stress. And of course, there's lots of things that you can do to help with stress, like we said. So we won't dive too much into that. But immune system level, you know, feed good foods, all of that jazz.
Basically, when it comes down to it, we're talking mental health for fish here.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, it's, you know, healthy fish are going, you know, this sounds stupid, but I'm going to say it anyway. Mentally stimulated fish are healthier fish, you know, fish that have, there's clear papers on this stuff, on brain development and immune response and development of antibodies and things like that. Fish that are stimulated by having good foods, are living in schools, if they're schooling fish, if they have a dynamic environment, like having, you know, rocks and things like that, that they can hide in, all those types of things actually contribute to the fish's ability to defend against parasites and all other antigens.
I would say that, I would imagine that comes down to even feeding appropriately and often enough.
Yep.
So that they're not stressed out over, where's my meal? Where's my food? Who do I have to fight off for this?
Yep. And there's a perfect, correlation between feeding and them consuming food and cortisol levels going down. So when they eat food, cortisol levels actually drop. So when you feed multiple times a day and things like that, there's things that could happen that you know, could be bad. Like you could be contributing to you know, nutrient levels in your tank, but all these types of things can actually make your fish healthier. And just like anybody, you know, we all want to be fed certain amount of times a day and we want to not be starving, and all those things will stress you out.
And I think we have to get past the, oh, I can't feed because of nutrient levels in my tank argument. I think mm-hmm. we're at a place now where there are a lot of ways to manage your nutrient levels and keep things in balance. Animals and creatures need to eat.
Yeah.
If we didn't feed you for a while, you'd get pretty ticked off and not do well, right? And I think trying to not feed creatures at the expense of some algae or whatever, I think you need to do more thinking about how you're running things and manage the filtration better. Don't underfeed your creatures.
Yeah, like where we've come with filtration, you can filter your tank too much now. So it's not an issue anymore. And, you know, well-established tanks, you want to see feeding, go watch. Now I'm thinking. I'm forgetting his name, the octopus guy.
Oh, Rich Ross. Yeah, go watch Rich Ross feed his tank. He's the first to tell you, stop worrying about your levels, feed your creatures.
Yeah, exactly. Because well-established tanks that have good filtration can manage that amount of food and that biomass. You just need to do the work to make sure that you have that system set up. And I guess that's segueing into our next point. How do you manage ick levels? So how do you target the actual parasite? There's things like the obvious, by not introducing more ick into your tank. So as we said before, medicating, freshwater dips, drying out equipment before it goes in your tank, all those things are good ideas in managing the number of individuals in your tank, ick individuals in your tank. Assuming, you know, just even though you're conceding that there's ick in your tank, doing those types of quarantine methods will still reduce the number of individuals in the tank, which helps with your ick tipping point.
Yeah. So I've started installing UV sterilizers now on my service tanks. And I got to thank BRS for that, because they really do offer a great service. They've put out there a ton of information because they have the time and the ability to put it in. And they've done a lot of great talks lately on UV sterilization and how to do it properly and how to make it effective. And I think it really leads into what you're talking about with the tipping points. It's not going to wipe it out. And they're very clear in there when they say, well, you have to think about what sterilization is. It's not killing the ick. It is sterilizing it so it can't reproduce.
Yep.
To keep it under control.
Yeah, those guys have done the hobby a huge service by doing that research. I was reading the papers and the work was there. You know, the how does it go? It's basically like how long and how intense the light needs to be and how long the parasite needs to be exposed to the light in order to be sterilized. Interesting fact about that is that the research that's done on UV light and its effect on parasites is actually done on the freshwater species, not on the saltwater species. So as far as I know, everything that we say about UV's effects on saltwater parasites is anecdotal, and it's assumed based on what it does to basically everything else. It's not true. That's just me saying, like, in the papers, they haven't actually tested it with the saltwater parasite,
But I can tell you, because I've been to some of the big wholesalers in LA, I've been to Quality Marine, I've been to various places, and those guys are running massive amounts of UV sterilization.
Yeah,
that's a big, that's a big investment. So there's got to be a reason for that.
Yeah, just because they tested it on the freshwater species doesn't mean it doesn't work on the others. It's just that the effects of UV on everything is the same. It degrades the DNA, basically. So that the effects are on everything. It's just an interesting point that I found when I was reading it. UV, I run UV now on all my tanks too. I run UV, like they say, BRS has shown, you have to pick the right UV sterilizer for the right job. Meaning, you know, if you're targeting bacterias, if you're targeting protozoans, if you're targeting diatoms, algae, those types of things, the time that the amount of water that you need to run through the pump is faster versus different parasites because they need a longer exposure to the light.
And that's a whole nother thing too. You have to get into a whole talk on that, because you can't just look at your pump and say, well, my pump does this.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I'll just tune the pressure to that. When we were just ran into this with the one we're installing right now, the tank is 300 gallons. It's on the second floor. By the time we get things up there and through the sterilizer, et cetera, what I had from the pump is not what I have as actual flow through the system. So you either have to put on a flow meter, or you have to take a gallon jug at the end of the line where it's draining back into your sump and time it for a gallon and multiply it and do some math and stuff and figure out what your actual flow rate is to be accurate. You can't just slap it on and say, hey, great, I've used free sterilizer, because you could be effectively doing nothing.
Yeah. And like the good brands, and it's kind of getting past me what some of the good brands are.
Aquava Ultraviolet is good. Yeah. Pentair is another one that's out there. I'm sure there's a bunch. You know, ones you buy for $60 that say they twist and do all that, I'd question how effective they really are if they're powerful enough.
Yeah. I mean, and some of those ones seem like they work better on freshwater systems. But saltwater, I mean, it's an investment. You've got to spend the money up front, get the right equipment, do the work to make sure you have the right flow rate. But if you do it all right and you set that up properly, the effects are real, and they're worth the investment if that's the route you want to go. So for example, if you set up a UV sterilizer right on the tank, you're effectively raising your tipping point away from, you know, those lower values. So you can have, But basically what you're doing is you're lowering the number of individuals in your tank so that the populations are going to have a higher time getting up there, getting to a point where they cross that tipping point and they start to kill your fish. If anybody's sick of me saying it, tipping points, I'm with you.
We could turn it into a drinking game. Yeah. We're going to take a shot when he says tipping point.
Yeah, just try living a day in the life of my wife. So basically that's the gist about UV sterilizers. I think that pretty much, you know, that covers the kind of idea on ick tipping points drink. And I think that it does kind of cover all that stuff.
So just to summarize it, you know, you said, population control, watch where you're getting your fish from, diet, make sure you're feeding them a balanced diet, giving what they need, water quality, travel time, et cetera, et cetera. Like, consider your fish like you would consider your dog.
Yeah. And it's all very common sense. If you think of things at a level of an ecosystem level, you know, the dynamics of the community of fish that are in your tanks matters. If you're introducing fish that have are more susceptible to ick, then you've got to do the extra work to make sure that ick individuals are lower in number than sure. they would be in other tanks.
And it's a closed system. It's yep. not the ocean where they can disperse. If yep. they start to grow, they're just going to multiply. And the more of them there are, the easier it is to multiply for obvious yep. reasons.
Yep, exactly. And so that's a good one. A couple other interesting things that I found from the literature. One thing was that in the ick life cycle, so I can't get the names right now off the top of my head, but basically ick goes through this life cycle where it, you know, it's an egg, it attaches to the fish, there's a free swimming stage. And basically in that free swimming stage, which I think is called the theront stage, that's when they're most susceptible to medications. So in theory, you want to target that period when they're in that theront stage. And there was papers that were saying it was between 9 p.m. and 2 a.m. When those therons are out. So that's when ick is mostly in its free swimming stage. So I wouldn't recommend, you know, this per se, but like if you only want to run your UV sterilizer for a certain time period, make sure it's during that time period. If you're going to be introducing medications, try to target that time period. It's at night. They're in that free swimming stage because of predation. So it was kind of an interesting thing.
I know it gets said over and over, but just because you don't see it on the fish anymore doesn't mean that it's gone.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it could be in one of those other stages. It could have laid eggs. Like that's why there's an extended period of time when you're trying to treat these things.
Yeah.
Because you have to wait for the next round and get rid of that.
Yeah. And speaking on those cycles.
Second wave, if you will.
Second wave, yeah. speaking on those cycles, this is kind of interesting too. I thought this blew my mind when I was reading it. So because of the life cycles of the parasite, because it's so fast, and as I said before, the genetic lines of the fish will degrade over time, aka if there isn't any new ick parasites coming into the tank, then there's no new genetics coming into the tank. And if there's no new genetics coming into the tank, that means that you have some ick brothers and sisters that are making ick babies together. So what happens is the genes in the tank starts to go down. So those cell lines start to go down and degrade over time to a point where they're non-viable. This paper showed, basically what they were trying to do was just keep ick populations in a tank going high. And the only way they could do that was to keep introducing fish. So what that means is that ick, well, this, I kind of skipped over this point. Fish can develop a immune response to ick and can actually develop an immunity to it. So that's a question that goes around a lot, is can fish become immune? Yes. The research actually shows that for periods of time, ick can develop an immunity. So they, when it comes to a specific immune responses, like that would be things like antibodies. So
I was just going to ask. I was going to ask for everybody. So when you say immune, it sounds funny to my ear because I think of ick as an animal,
right?
It's like almost like a leech. It's sucking on that thing. So how does? It's not like a virus per se, where it's, you know, creating something and kicking it out. Is the fish doing something to repel?
Yeah, so basically what's happening is like the fish is developing, the way that I'm understanding it is that when the parasite attacks the fish, it's tearing away its flesh, it's doing things like that. And bacteria are what are eventually getting into the fish and causing the fish to die as it kind of strips the energy away from the fish. So basically what happens is that antigen, aka so like any bad thing that comes into the body, can loosely be called an antigen. And the response would be an antibody. So what the fish is doing is creating a specific antibody that targets the antigens that are happening in the tank. So I get what you're saying. Like, well, is it developing some specific, you know, defense that's causing the ick to fall off? Not really, but what's happening is that the immune response to that specific problem gets better, and the mast
Okay,
cells that are produced.
so it's not necessarily stopping the ick from munching on it, but it's developed a way to fight off the bacteria or whatever that might be coming as a side effect. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. So if you go down kind of the criteria of like what is a fish's immune response? So you have specific, non-specific, and behavioral. So specific would be specific defenses, aka like things like antibodies, like a vaccine, you know. So they're giving the fish the tools to defend against that specific problem, right? Non-specific are things like fish slime. So those are things like whatever touches me, I'm going to produce this thing that's going to try to defend against it. So that's what fish slime is doing. It's protecting the skin, scales, things like that are all
Trying to slough it
non-specific.
off.
Right. And then there's behavioral. In the wild, behavioral defenses work a little bit better. So like if a parasite comes onto a fish in the wild, the numbers are probably low enough that, you know, maybe picking it off or rubbing against the ground, jumping, salmon even do it to defend against sea lice. They'll
Okay.
jump, so to dislodge this the parasite in our tanks. Unfortunately, I think, and this, I don't know if this is true or not, but I personally think that behavioral responses don't work very well in a tank because they don't have. You can't be like in an area where there's ick in a tank and move away from it because the
Right,
tank
yeah.
is confined. So behavioral responses don't work as well. So basically getting back to the whole immune response and the fish's ability to actually defend the ick parasite. And once it sees enough of this thing and it defends it enough, and you know it's starting to get better at producing the things that are getting this ick off of you. So it's developing better non-specific defenses, it's producing more slime, things like that, because it's healthy. And then anytime that it does develop a little bit of an infection or a bacterial issue that has been caused because of the ick, now the antibodies, the specific defenses, the T cells, the B cells, things like that are going to be able to target that issue. So let's just say now the fish is immune. It's been exposed to the ick in small doses. It's developed an immune response, and now it's like, okay, I got these guys, right? Like it wasn't like I'm gonna throw 10,000 wasps at you. I'm gonna throw 10, and then I'm gonna throw 15, and all of a sudden you're just like a ninja wasp killer, right? Like you've just gotten better at it. That's the same idea with fish. So in theory, this is the idea. So what I was getting at, if you have a tank and you don't introduce any new fish to that tank for a 1 year period, in theory, the ick populations in that tank will have degraded so far that it's likely that they're completely eradicated from your tank. So that was like kind of mind-blowing, because this whole idea of ick eradication and ick management is, if you didn't start your tank from very day one and you didn't start with ick eradication, you're never going to get there. You have to manage ick populations in your tank from here on out. You're not going to be able to eradicate them. But that's not actually true. So for those who can do it, if you have a really established tank and you're like, I don't need to introduce any new fish for a year, you just leave that tank for a year. Now you're assuming, and you don't introduce anything new.
I was
You
just going to
let
say, because if you introduce a coral or something and there's a one of the certain stages that's on that,
yeah.
you're still introducing.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a chance. The number of individuals that'll be on like a coral frag would be so small that I don't think you'd even have to worry about it. If you're introducing new fish, different story. The other thing is, I think we speak in general terms a lot of the species of ick that are actually coming into our terms and always calling them like the cryptocurrens. It could be different families. So basically, if you're introducing, you know, you went 9 months, you didn't introduce any new fish. You bought one coral frag, you did a quick dip on it, and then you put it in your tank. That's the other thing. There's a lot of great products now for dipping corals and things like that that work on corals that you don't use with fish. that will kind of wipe out ick, especially because ick has no reason to be on those things. So it's not as likely that they'll be there in big numbers. Difference sure. being on fish. But so let's just say you can go a whole year without buying any new fish, and you haven't bought any, you know, massive colonies of corals, and you didn't dip them or anything. Let's just say you use some common sense. You dipped things every now and then. You didn't bring in huge colonies. You didn't bring in anybody's weird equipment or anything. And you just left your tank. You didn't introduce any new fish for a year. In theory, your tank is back down to ground zero. There's no ick in your tank, and you can go under that assumption. So you have this tank now that is in your mind, has no ick. You don't need to worry about it. Maybe that's a great time to start investing in fish that have been quarantined, you know, paying the extra money and getting your fish quarantined for you. It's just, it was really interesting to hear that. To read that.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, because it offers up this whole new thing, because everybody gets into this, you know, point of defeat where it's like, well, shit, I've had this tank set up for 6 years. You know, I didn't know about all this stuff about ick management, ick eradication, and blah, blah, blah. What am I going to do now? But most people...
The genetic thing is interesting because sometimes you just need someone to point these things out, because we would know that as a general fact of life on any level. You can't breed within your own family because it degrades the species mm-hmm. over time, et cetera, et cetera. Or even when we were talking to Aaron
yeah.
about his coral restoration, he's very careful to make sure that he's getting genetic diversity in yep. the samples that he puts on each site for this very reason, to make it stronger, not weaker.
Yeah. And the big thing too is we use the life cycle for our benefit. Humans have a longer life cycle, 100 years or whatever, where with ick, it's really quick. It can be a couple of days. So that works in our favor because they can actually go through generations and generations and generations within months, where it would right. take us hundreds of years. They can do it in a matter of months. And those genetic things that take really long periods of time happen really quickly to them, where to us, it doesn't happen as quickly. So it's a benefit that we should work with. And you can do things like temperature, for example. If you're running your tank a little bit warmer, the life cycle is going to be a little bit faster. If you're running a little bit slower, it's going to be a little bit slower. So yeah, that's cool. Yeah, it's
so basically it all circles back around to treat your fish like you treat any of your family, your kids, your pet, or anything else. Good environment, good water quality, good foods, the right nutrition, get them exercise, keep them stimulated, keep your fish physically and mentally healthy so that yep. it can fight off anything, just like any of us would try and fight off a cold.
Yep, exactly. You know, like in my mind, it always comes down to stress. And yep. then on a deeper level than that, it always comes down to energetic management. So you want these fish to be using their energy to grow, to reproduce, to do all those fun things. You don't want every single ounce of energy to be going into just stay alive. Because that's when the immune system starts to break down. And that's when these parasites get to a point where they can wipe them out.
Cool.
So that's the ick.
There you go.
So I've been staring at... I
think you should have gone to the number one school. That was some pretty good information.
that's funny. Your Bashcy Canada shirt, I've been staring at it this whole time. I'm gonna I'm gonna hit up Jose about one of those.
You want Jose? I'm sure he'll hook you up.
You know, and I was also thinking we should get him out here. He's anybody.
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
So, Jose would come on for sure.
Yeah, I'll shoot a message or something for those listening. Jose's running the Bashcy Canada. Bashcy makes the sumps that, if you've seen them, you know, they're
the sumps. We use them in all of our builds. It's a good quality, nice product.
Yeah. Super flashy. You know, that's the type of sump that you display. You want people to see it. It's beautiful. Solid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that'd be cool.
Yeah, for sure.
So anyway, anything else you wanted to cover on that topic?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think we pretty much covered it.
It's pretty good. It's not a new topic, I know, but it's something that people always have questions about. It's something I have to deal with daily.
Yep.
Trying to stay ahead of this stuff. When it comes down to it, you got to put in the work. You got to treat them like you would treat anything else. So be prepared. Don't wait till you see something. Have things in place so that, oh, geez, I need to deal with this, but it's not a big deal. Reduce your stress. Yep. So you're prepared to do it. Like, it's the same kind of thing, right?
Yep. Yep. All the things that you should be doing to keep yourself healthy right now, applies to your fish.
Yeah.
The next
thing,
it's
not a huge thing to do. If you need a quarantine system, it's not a big expensive outlay. You don't need expensive lights or any crazy things. It's relatively simple.
Yeah, we can do another poll show about quarantine. I can show exactly how I do it.
I'll see if we can get Pat on for that, because he's really good with that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, it would be great too. Cause so Pat runs a wholesale, you know, aquarium.
Pat runs Reef Wholesale in Toronto. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. So like, he can show it from like what he does on his level and like how you do it properly on a big scale. And then yeah, we can talk about, you know, I know lots of people who do quarantine differently at home, and you know, everybody has a budget and how they want to do it. And there's ways to do it for damn near zero. It barely costs you anything. You can use equipment that you have laying around.
Yeah.
Or you can go crazy, you know, all out and make sure that your system is pristine. So it's mm-hmm. depends on how you want to do it, but. Sweet. The next thing I really will be diving into is the reef chemistry. Okay. So I'm gonna try to have a video on that one.
Because I think we should engage Lou from Tropic Marin in that. He's awesome at explaining and dealing with that stuff.
Oh, I'd love it. Yeah, because
I guarantee he would. He's such a great guy.
Yeah, it's another one where I feel like everybody has a good, you know, baseline on reef chemistry and. But
he has a couple of great videos out there already that I refer to people all the time in the store. He just has a way of breaking it down and cutting through too much of the science.
Yeah.
So that the general public can grasp what he's saying. You don't have to be a biologist to understand what the concept is.
Yeah, like practical reef chemistry.
Yeah.
And that's like the most interesting anyway.
So. Yeah, and when you really understand it, it makes a big difference.
Totally. It makes a massive difference. So anyway, one thing we missed out on this episode was any new news about coral reef conservation.
Haven't, as far as the eco divers go, I haven't heard a ton lately. As far as I know, they're just plugging away. They're essentially COVID free in Cayman now. So they're pretty much going about their daily lives
nice.
As best that they can. I did see the other day that they're going to open up the borders a little bit, but you have to prove that you have a COVID test negative. And there was another thing you had to do too. I forget. There's two things that you had to do anyways to be let into the country, or you had to quarantine for 14 days when you get there. So I don't have either of those things yet, but soon I probably will. So I'm looking forward to getting back down there and getting to work with Aaron again.
Yeah.
Hopefully sooner than later.
Yep. The other nice thing with the new year. So we are going to be, we're recording this in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
There were some promising stories that came out about recovery of coral reefs during this,
You had a good period. Post on your For the Reef Facebook page the other day about that.
Yeah, there was like, so, you know, all these papers, they don't come out super fast. Like a lot of the good stuff, it takes a while for it to get out. So, you know, we're still in COVID. So to know exactly what all of this impacts or the benefits of a lockdown like this were on the natural environment, it's going to take some time. But preliminary stuff showed some recovery on the Great Barrier Reef from the massive warming events that happened in the last decade. So I think it was like 2 or 3 years ago, they had a major warming event that wiped out a big portion of the corals. Some of the soft corals, like we call them, seem to be coming back. But in this news, there were some of the stony corals that were actually showing signs of recovery. So in areas where they looked like they were going to be dying off completely, in the last part of 2020, they recovered a bunch. So very promising news. Another good thing was parrotfish populations started to come back. So there was some ecological benefits of COVID. Mm-hmm. So it'd be interesting to see
how shows much what the world can do if we leave it alone a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you know, like, it's not, you know, it's one thing when you always talk about coral reef conservation and you talk about climate change a lot, or especially if you're in the environmental science field, you can get really caught up in all of the negative stuff going on in the world. So it's important to always reflect on positive news, positive things, because it's just a good thing, good takeaway. Mm-hmm. So but anyway, it was a fun one tonight. Hopefully we'll get another one out soon.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks again, guys. As I always say, you can reach us at fortherieffpodcast@gmail.com. you can find Ian at Sustainable Marine Canada. Sustainable Marine Canada is a fish store which operates online, and its headquarters is in London, Ontario. So if you want to pick up supplies, they are sponsoring this episode. So
every episode.
Yeah. And you can definitely you can find me at For the Reef Apparel. You can always hit me up on Facebook, whatever you guys want. So I would love to hear some feedback from any listeners out there. You know, if this is something you're enjoying, it helps to motivate us to keep doing these and bring on some awesome guests. So,
yeah. And like we said, we try and handle this as just like the way, this is how Mitch and I would chat if we were hanging out in the store. Right. And sometimes it goes off the rails and sometimes you bring it back, but these are the talks that we have and we like to keep it casual.
Yeah, totally. All right, guys. Till next time.
Stay safe. Wear your mask.
Adios. We'll be right back.